Good to see you. In fact, I'm very nervous. I hope I can make sense today instead of babbling for 30 minutes. So we go to John. In John chapter 21 to 22, there is recorded a series of appearances of Jesus after his resurrection. These are not random incidents, but are rather deliberate and intentional, and each with a special person in mind. Those to whom Jesus appeared include Mary Magdalene, the 12, especially Thomas, and finally Peter. These persons are not random individuals either. They are specifically chosen because of their various conditions, such as sadness, doubt, and has lost their sense of purpose. All in all, these individuals exemplified what later Christians, including you and I, will experience, and the comfort and encouragement they can receive from these witnesses. And the message to us is this: Jesus, the high priest, not only prays for the ones he loves, he also comes to them in their sorrows and struggles. This is incarnation in real life situations. So first, let us look at what happened to Mary Magdalene. Early in the morning, when it was still dark, Mary went to the tomb. Why? The text does not say. Presumably, she went there to mourn Jesus as per the custom of the day. She may have felt this was necessary because of the circumstances surrounding Jesus' death. The Sabbath of the Passover was fast approaching. The days was nearly over, and they could only prepare Jesus' body for burial in a hurry. As a result, there was no time to mourn him properly. And moreover, as John 11:31 indicates, it was the duty of the women at that day to mourn the dead. The text suggests that she went there alone, in contrast to the synoptics. When she got there, she found that the stone blocking the entrance was rolled away. She then ran to inform the disciples, and two of the disciples, Peter and the disciple whom Jesus loved, went with her to the tomb to see what had happened. Now both disciples were gone. Only Mary was left lingering behind at the entrance of the tomb. And she was crying, not just because Jesus was dead, but also because his body was now lost, and she felt so helpless. As she was weeping, the text said she bent over to look into the tomb. Let us take a moment to imagine what a Jewish tomb in the first century looked like. The location of the tomb of Jesus is quite well known. It is located inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the old city of Jerusalem, like this one. The tomb itself is located under the big dome on the left. The church was built in the 4th century AD by Queen Helena, the mother of the Roman Emperor Constantine. The purpose was to preserve and venerate the site. However, ironically, it ended up destroying the site. So the original form and shape of the tomb was no longer discernible. But luckily, there are an abundance of tombs to help us, for the hills surrounding Jerusalem are dotted with them, some dating back to the Old Testament times. Generally, The tombs are carved into the side of a mountain. The entrance is quite small, dug into the side of the mountain and quite close to ground level, like this one. So if Mary is to look inside the tomb, she has to get down on her hands and knees. And this is what we imagine Mary was doing. What she would be looking at would be the burial chamber, which was carved inside the mountain with niches on the side for multiple burials. And this one. And when she looked, she saw two angels in white, sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other one at the feet. Remember that the burial clothes of Jesus were still in the tomb, lying there undisturbed, in verses 6 to 7. The presence of the angels all by itself is a very powerful statement that the body of Jesus was missing, not because somebody, such as grave robbers, took it, but that he was raised from the dead by the power of God. But Mary, in her sadness and confusion, did not realize this. So she said to the angels with tears in her eyes, that they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him. At this point, Jesus appeared and stood behind Mary. When she sensed someone was there, Mary turned and asked the man the whereabouts of Jesus' body, not recognizing that the man was Jesus himself. And then the moment of revelation. Jesus called her name Mary. Then Mary responded by saying, Rabboni. Actually, it should be pronounced Rabboni, the accent on the last syllable, which means my teacher. What we are witnessing is a very intimate moment, like two good friends greeting each other after a long absence. They don't have to say a lot, but they can understand each other perfectly. Words are few, but the meaning and implications are profound. We can sense there's a depth of feelings and emotions here, which are difficult to capture with words, may even be despoiled by words. The scene strongly conveys to us the feeling that Jesus did not just happen to be there. He came on purpose. He came specially for Mary. He was seeking Mary out, so to speak. He came looking for her on purpose. And Mary, once she heard the voice of Jesus calling her name, responded so naturally, almost instinctively, by saying, Rabboni. The translation, teacher, does not adequately capture the depth of the meaning of this address. Rabboni, or Rabboni, is actually a term of endearment, full of intimacy and respect. It tells us what Jesus meant for Mary. But most importantly, this exchange reminds us of Jesus saying in the parables of the Good Shepherd in John 10, where in verse 3, Jesus says that the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name. And then in verse 27, he says, my sheep hear my voice. I know them, and they follow me. What's the meaning of all this? What Jesus said in John 10 was not just a parable. It is not theoretical, but real life experiences. Jesus calling to Mary demonstrates clearly how much he loves his own. And because of his love, Jesus true to his promise, came especially for Mary when she was lost in grief and overcome by sorrow. What's more, being a woman in those days bore the stigma of not being trusted. They were not valued highly. As a woman, Mary was marginalized. However, in spite of all this, she was the one whom Jesus came especially for. He came to bring her peace, to comfort her, to console her, to restore her faith in him, and also commissioned her to announce the good news. Furthermore, Jesus drawing near to Mary again reminds us of another saying of Jesus in John 6:39. It says, "This is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day." Translation: that we are safe in the hands of Jesus. Jesus indeed is the good shepherd, and we his sheep. We can all see part of ourselves in the experience of Mary. We are often overcome by the sense of lostness, whether due to despair, sadness, or confusion. The sense of lostness being so pervasive in human experiences. Our text encourages two things. One, to remember Mary when we find ourselves in similar circumstances. And two, that Jesus would never let us slip from his hands. He is the good shepherd. He gathers his flock around him to protect them. And Mary was not the only one whom Jesus sought out expressly. The other one Jesus came looking for on this special day was Thomas. Again, Jesus really cares for his disciples. He would not allow any one of them to lose his or her way. He must bring them home, back into the fold. Let me read to you once again the passage, but beginning with verse 24 this time. John 20:24. But Thomas, who was called a twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nails, and my hand in his side, I will not believe." Then verse 26. A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." We used to think about Thomas as the one who's skeptical. Otherwise, why do we call him the doubting Thomas? He really doesn't mind to voice his doubt explicitly, as in John 25, we just read. But there's more to the picture of Thomas. In John 11:8, when Jesus announced that they were going to Lazarus, who had recently died, his disciples reminded him that the Jews had not long ago almost stoned him to death. When Jesus explained that he needed to go to Judea to wake Lazarus up, the disciples again assured Jesus that if Lazarus had just fallen asleep, then all was well. Translation: that they were reluctant or afraid to go to Judea because it's too risky, and wanted to persuade Jesus not to go, better to play it safe. Finally, when Jesus indicated his determination to go, then Thomas said to his fellow disciples in verse 16, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." The picture of Thomas that emerges here is that he appears to be a devoted but pessimistic follower of Jesus. Pessimistic because he thought they all would eventually die, and the kingdom of God announced by Jesus would be no more. Again in John 14:5, Thomas appears to be loyal but undiscerning. In the discourse of John 14, Jesus said to the disciples that he would go to prepare a place for them in his Father's house, and that the disciples knew the way. Thomas responded by saying, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way?" He could not grasp the true meaning of what Jesus has just said. He thought Jesus was going to another location on earth which was inaccessible to them. Again, Thomas demonstrated that he was loyal but lacked discernment. Now in the evening of the day of the Lord's resurrection, when the disciples witnessed to him that they had seen the Lord, he declared in no uncertain terms that unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe. Thomas' position illustrates well that Jesus had what Jesus had described earlier in John 4:48, that unless people see signs and wonders, they will not believe. And so this is the spiritual condition of Thomas. There's one positive thing we can say about Thomas, and that he is honest, not being hypocritical. And just as Jesus came to search for Mary, so he came also especially for Thomas. And the timing is also interesting. Jesus did not come in any other day, but on the 8th day after the resurrection, which was also a Sunday. This is very touching, isn't it? Jesus came especially for a disciple who was a bit pessimistic about the mission of Jesus, slow to understand, even professed openly that he needed physical proof of the resurrection, thereby questioning the entire announcement of Jesus about his own death and resurrection, and ultimately the promise of God. Judging by human standards, Thomas failed the test of discipleship miserably. But Jesus is not ready to give up on him. He refused to let Thomas, to leave Thomas with his doubt and unbelief. He came to him to restore Thomas to faith, to pull him out of his lack of discernment. Again, Jesus demonstrated that he was true to his word. What God the Father has entrusted to him, he would not allow any one of them to be lost, however small or however weak. Like the good shepherd who takes care of the weak, the sick, the lame, even the broken of the flock, so would Jesus take care of the weakest of the disciples. The good shepherd would not leave any one of his flock behind. He would rather leave the 99 healthy sheep behind in order to go looking for one that has lost his way. So what's the lesson for us today? Let me direct your attention to John 20:29, where Jesus said to Thomas, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." The first part of the verse sounds like a criticism or a judgment. But why would Jesus criticize Thomas? And some commentators or translations, such as the NIV, takes the first part of the verse not as a question, but as a direct statement. "Because you have seen me, you have believed." Jesus was referring to Thomas' confession, "My Lord and my God," just a moment ago. I think this is a better interpretation. So understood, Jesus was not criticizing Thomas' lack of faith, but commends and encourages him. And by doing so, also encourages all those who come after Thomas and the disciples, which include us. We are the ones who have not seen and yet have come to believe. So by saying this, Jesus is pointing us to the example of Thomas, especially his direct, unambiguous confession, "My Lord and my God." The meaning of the passage is clear. Jesus, the resurrected Lord, comes especially for those who are weak in faith, those who are in danger of losing their grip on faith, in order to restore them, to strengthen them, to help them to bear fruit. He will not leave anyone behind, no matter how poor their conditions are. I hope we'll all find encouragement in today's message. And I will say no more. You will sing my closing words, actually. The hymn of response is, "He Will Hold Me Fast." I think will capture the message of today beautifully. But let me read to you the first stanza of the hymn. It says, "When I fear my faith will fail, Christ will hold me fast. When a tempter would prevail, he will hold me fast. I could never keep my hope through life's fearful path, for my love is often cold, but he must hold me fast." God's blessing to you all.